Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, rotavirus immunization, what we know and what is still unanswered, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Penelope H. Dennehy, MD, Mary Ellen Statt, MD, MPH, and Andy L. Shane, MD, MPH, MSc. Dr. Dennehy is a professor and vice chair of pediatrics, the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University, Director, Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Hasbro Children's Hospital, Providence, Rhode Island. Dr. Dennehy has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She received grants for clinical research from Merck & Company, Roche, and MedImmune. Dr. Dennehy does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Dennehy does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Statt is a professor of pediatrics, University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Director, International Adoption Center, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Cincinnati, Ohio. Dr. Statt has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for GlaxoSmithKline, MedImmune, and Merck & Company. She served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Merck & Company. She received grants for clinical research from GlaxoSmithKline, MedImmune, and Merck & Company. Dr. Statt does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Statt does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Shane is an assistant professor of infectious pediatric diseases, Emory University School of Medicine, attending physician, infectious pediatric diseases, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Shane has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Claire Laboratories. Dr. Shane does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Shane does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to address barriers to improving rotavirus vaccination rates in infants and young children in the United States. This activity is supported by Merck & Company. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Penelope Dennehy from the Alpert Medical School of Brown University and Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. I'd like to welcome you to this Medscape Roundtable discussion on rotavirus vaccine, what we know, and what is still unanswered. I'd also like to welcome my colleagues, Dr. Andy Shane from Emory University School of Medicine. Welcome, Andy. Glad to have you here.
Wonderful to be here.
And Dr. Mary Statt from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And Mary, it's great to have you here as well.
Thank you, Penny.
I'm going to start with some introductory comments, which will set the scene for the rest of our discussion this evening. We're going to talk about what happened in the pre-vaccine era in terms of rotavirus disease burden, and then move on to talk about what effects the vaccine has had. Diarrhea disease is the second largest cause of pediatric deaths worldwide. It kills 1.8 million children yearly. Rotavirus is really our single most important agent, and the death toll is highest in Africa, followed by Asia and Latin America. Rotavirus causes a large number of deaths in the developing world, but it also causes a large amount of morbidity as well, with hospitalizations and outpatient visits. And it's clear that under age 5, every child experiences at least one rotavirus infection. In the United States, we have many fewer deaths, with only about 20 to 40 deaths per year in the pre-vaccine era. But we do have a large amount of children hospitalized, somewhere between 500 and 700,000 children, 70,000 children, excuse me, 50 to 70,000 children, and over 150,000 ER visits and over 400,000 office visits per year. And it's clear that almost every child in the United States under the age of 5 experienced a rotavirus infection prior to vaccine introduction. Two vaccines are licensed currently in the United States and are used here and elsewhere in the world. One of them is a bovine reassortant vaccine, RV5 or Rotatec, which has 5 human bovine reassortants and represents the major serotypes that are seen around the world. The second vaccine is a live attenuated human rotavirus vaccine, RV1 or Rotarix, which contains one strain of human rotavirus but shares neutralizing epitopes with the common strains throughout the world. The efficacy of these rotavirus vaccines was remarkably similar in clinical trials. Both of them had efficacies that ranged from 72 to 100% in high and middle income countries with low mortality rates and 46 to 72% in low income countries with high child mortality rates. Trials in the developing countries of Africa and Asia have shown lower efficacy of the vaccines, but a larger absolute number of severe cases of rotavirus prevented through vaccination. These vaccines are now licensed in over 125 countries. Introduction began in the year 2006. Currently, they're available in the private sector in many countries and are part of national immunization programs in 28 countries worldwide. Over 50% of these countries are in Latin America, and some are low-income, are lower-middle-income countries where rotavirus disease is more severe. With donor support, the Gavi Alliance plans to introduce rotavirus vaccine in more than 40 low-income countries by the year 2015. Now, vaccines often perform well in clinical trials, but the real test is whether they perform well under the conditions they're normally given, under real-world conditions. And the studies that have been done in a variety of low, middle, and high-income countries show that the vaccine effectiveness has been really comparable to the efficacy that was seen in clinical trials. And that's really exciting. It shows these vaccines really work in the real world. Vaccine impact studies that have been done also document that the burden of rotavirus disease has been significantly reduced since the introduction of rotavirus vaccines. We've seen reductions in hospitalizations and ED visits of up to 90% and reductions in office visits by at least 15%. And similar reductions have been seen in all-cause gastroenteritis, suggesting that rotavirus is the major cause of these illnesses. So let's start with our conversation. One of the things we wanted to talk about was what populations are at risk for rotavirus disease, especially in the United States.
Well, I think we've really had just a tremendous story, tremendous success story with what's happened with the rotavirus immunization program in the United States. But I think it's really important to realize that really all children still are at risk for rotavirus disease. And, every child's going to be at risk up to 5 years of age and maybe even later. And I think it's important that we just continue with our efforts to make sure these children are immunized. Some children may be a little bit higher risk, such as premature babies, children with underlying diseases, but truly it's a disease that every child will get, and it's important to continue up with our immunization program.
So let's talk a bit about some cases. We all get asked questions, and I think that some of the things that are of interest are there children that present to you or to your colleagues that you've been asked about that present particular problems with rotavirus vaccine?
Yeah, I know for me, I'm the director of an international adoption center at our site, and we have a number of children that will come home that are past the time when they could have received the rotavirus immunization. They're too old, they've aged out. And so, that I think poses a specific problem. We'll have a child that maybe come home from Ethiopia, 6 months of age. They didn't have the opportunity to get vaccinated in Ethiopia because it's not available there yet. And now here they are. They've come home, 6 months of age. Mom wants that child to get immunized for everything that they should get immunized for. And, what can we do? And I think that's a problem that, has been posed for me personally as I take care of kids. But, there are other immigrants and refugees that come home to the United States and, have the same problem.
Now, Andy, you work at Emory, which has a large international presence. You work with folks from the Centers for Disease Control. And so you've probably thought about this. What are your feelings on what we should do about these children?
Well, similar to Mary's experience, there's the rotavirus vaccine age limitations do create some problems when you have children who may exceed those age limitations and who would benefit from the vaccine. Clearly, in those situations, we don't have the data to support immunizing those children. Some of the other issues are that the availability of the vaccine is variable in different countries around the world. We do find that some children are immunized or partially immunized before they come to the United States, and that is helpful and may provide them with some protection. Also, the one concern about the age limitation, which we'll get into a discussion a little bit later, is a discussion about the association with intussusception and how that may impact on the age limitations. But there is good news, as we know from the epidemiological studies in the past few years, that with immunization of many children, we're now seeing herd protection. And so, therefore, those children who may not be able to be immunized or incompletely immunized may have protection from their contacts who have been immunized.
Well, I think it's also important to note that the reason the recommendations are the way they are is that the studies were done to in young children because the risk of intussusception goes up starting about 6 to 7 months of age and peaks around 9 months of age. So the studies were done to avoid intussusception risk, and so we don't have data in those older children. So what would you tell a family that you weren't able, such as the Ethiopian child that you presented, what would you tell that family?
I would just tell them that the guidelines and the recommendations right now are that you can't really give that first dose of vaccine over 13 weeks of age. And because of that, you really need to be careful when you do see your child getting acute gastroenteritis to monitor their hydration status and seek care if they get dehydrated.
Great. So one of the other groups that we have issues with is premature infants. I know I get asked questions quite frequently about the premature infant that's still in the NICU, not going home for a while. So, Mary, do you want to just talk about what you have thought about and what you do with these sorts of children?
I think you'll have lots of different opinions on this one because as we talk with our colleagues, there's just so many different opinions about what they're doing. And really the whole hospital gets involved about what to do from an infection control standpoint. And we know that both vaccines are shed in the stool when they're given. And so there's a concern about not only just safety, but whether or not they're shedding that other children that who for whatever reason might be contraindicated in or have precautions for might get somehow transmitted this vaccine virus to them. And so we have, a whole NICU full of children that end up staying past the time period where you can give the vaccine. Perhaps we need to rethink whether or not we can change the recommendations so that we can give those, the vaccine to them.
I know around the country that there's different opinions. Mm-hmm. Andy, what's being done in the NICUs at Emory?
So we've actually started giving the RV5 vaccine to our neonates who would otherwise age out. What we try to do is give it as close to possible as their discharge to prevent the infection control issues that Mary alluded to. But for some children, that's not a possibility. And so we do give it and then advise to use the usual standard precautions that we advise for any child. And we've actually been doing this for the past 3 years and haven't had any safety issues and have been monitoring that quite closely.
Well, I know there's been some, at least a little bit of data suggesting there's relatively little transmission in households. And I think you were going to present that for us?
There was one study that's recently published looking at 15 children who were premature who received the rotavirus vaccine on schedule. And what the investigators did was look at the EIA for rotavirus detection in the stool, as well as comparing that with RT-PCR and cell culture, and looked at the relative excretion rates. It was very interesting because in this premature population, more than 50% of the children, there was rotavirus detectable by EIA, and actually up to 87% by RT-PCR. Only about 40% was the rotavirus detected in cell culture. So these were higher rates of excretion than we've seen in our term infants. But what was also interesting was they went and looked at the household contacts of each one of these infants, and interestingly enough, each one of them were asymptomatic. And so the investigators, although it was a very small sample size, concluded that in this group of neonates that there was low transmissibility of vaccine virus.
So Mary, is your nursery giving rotavirus vaccine?
We're right on the verge of thinking about it. We're very close. I think we're going to be using RV1 because that's what's used within our hospital system. And I think we're looking at it really the experience of others that have used it without having any problems, and the knowledge that we have that these premature babies really are babies that are at higher risk for having hospitalizations and having bigger problems with getting rotavirus. And so we are, I think, very close to starting at our institution.
My nursery has not yet moved that way, but we've moved to an all single bed nursery, which I think is providing more reassurance there'll be less transmission. So we'll see. But I know that around the country it's been a controversial thing, and I don't think we've managed to settle it here either. So let's move on to another vaccine or a vaccine safety issue, the whole issue of intussusception. We know the RotaShield vaccine was withdrawn from the market because of intussusception. We know that these vaccines, that's been one of the concerns as they've been licensed to really look at what we've seen with intussusception with both of these new vaccines. Clearly in the studies that led up to the licensure, the risk of intussusception seemed to be minimal. But what can you tell us about new information, Andy, about intussusception? Is there anything that we know now that is helpful in terms of making us feel more confident that intussusception is not an issue with these vaccines?
Well, Penny, I think looking outside of the United States for the moment, particularly in Mexico, Brazil, and Australia, where there have been recent studies done looking particularly at this question, what was seen in Mexico and the studies in Mexico and Australia was a slightly increased risk of intussusception within the first 7 days after giving the rotavirus vaccines. In Brazil, in contrast, this increased risk of intussusception was not seen. And so I think, once again, especially in international settings, we need to think about and weigh the risk and benefit. So a slightly increased risk of intussusception compared with the possibility of preventing rotavirus infections in children where mortality and morbidity is a very real issue.
Mm-hmm. Also, certainly this data from the United States, and Mary, what can you tell us about that data? I think it seems very reassuring.
First of all, I think it's just great that they're having such nice post-licensure safety studies done really everywhere to be looking at this issue, because it was such a big concern with RotaShield. And, you know, we definitely want to have studies in place, systems in place, to be able to reassure ourselves that we're not going to see that same issue. But we do have two large surveillance systems in place in the United States, VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and VSD, the Vaccine Safety Data Link. And in both of those systems, sponsored by the CDC, we have not seen an increased risk of intussusception with RV5, nor have we seen one with RV1. We clearly have more data on RV5 right now.
So we have a lot of doses now being delivered in the United States. I think it's over 30 million doses, and that's certainly very reassuring, because the risk was seen very shortly after the introduction of RotaShield. So we have many, many, many times the doses being delivered without that same signal. So
it's very, very reassuring.
You're right.
I think it should all feel comfortable that this looks like a very safe vaccine. Both of them do.
So let's talk about precautions for this vaccine. We've talked a lot about children who should and shouldn't get vaccines. So let's talk about which children we in particular think have issues about receiving vaccine. And again, there's some new data in this area. So what do we know about precautions, Andy?
So there are a couple of different precautions for the administration of rotavirus vaccine. I think the ones that we think about most frequently are altered immunocompetence, especially HIV, and children with severe combined immunodeficiency disease. And the other category that we think about are children who have pre-existing chronic gastrointestinal disease, especially our children with short gut. This is a little bit of an issue because these children are the ones who would probably have the most devastating consequences of a natural rotavirus infection. And so, well, once again, we have to weigh the risks and the benefits. Finally, infants who have spina bifida or bladder extrophy have a higher risk for latex allergy. And as we know, one of our vaccines, the RV1, that has an administrating system that has latex in it, these children should probably not get RV1.
I want to talk a little bit about HIV, because we certainly don't have data in the United States, but there is some data that is a little bit reassuring, at least to me, that HIV is not going to be an issue for children getting this vaccine.
We've seen some studies from South Africa, especially where there are high rates of HIV, and the rotavirus vaccines have been given without evidence of safety issues.
So that's reassuring. So really, I think the precaution is primarily for severe combined immunodeficiency infants. And so I think the recommendations, what would you say, Mary, in terms of recommendations that you would give about screen? Do we need to screen infants for this, or is this such a rare disease that and unlikely to be identified that it's really, if you have a family history or some other thing that might lead you to believe, but I don't think that the recommendations really warrant screening of everyone.
That was really a very hot topic at our institution because one of the case reports actually came from our institution. Right. And I think the problems are just, as you said, you know, oftentimes we don't know that the child has severe combined immune deficiency. You know, they're usually in the process of getting worked up. And so a lot of the discussion, you know, of the case reports that have come out of really, can we screen these kids and not really try to sort out whether or not we should give them the vaccine. I think probably they would choose not to give the vaccine as these children end up having very prolonged, you know, shedding of the virus and diarrheal disease. And so they, you know, perhaps would, I think, count on herd immunity and, you know, the cocooning that we talked about before. But I think most of the discussion I've seen has really been, can we screen for this? You know, because it would be helpful to know that they have it, so perhaps we can intervene with some of the other infections that they have early on.
Okay. What other misconceptions do you think physicians have about this vaccine? I think there are some still out in the community, though I think our physicians are being educated about the vaccine and do a good job. What things do you think are still things that might lead someone not to vaccinate a child or might lead to questions in their mind?
I think one of the greatest concerns is the concern about giving the vaccine to breastfed infants concomitantly with breastfeeding. In the United States, certainly the data shows that there is no reason not to give the vaccine to breastfeeding infants, and actually we should encourage breastfeeding as well because that offers additional protection. The other concern has been administering the vaccine to infants living in households where there are other immunocompromised children who are either known to be immunocompromised or may be suspected of being immunocompromised. That clearly is not a contraindication as well. And then also infants who are living with pregnant women should absolutely be immunized.
Well, I know this has come up with our other vaccines like varicella, for example. And certainly to me, it seems much worse that the child comes home with a natural rotavirus infection, shedding millions of viral particles that are going to infect everyone in the household versus someone who's vaccinated, who's coming and shedding relatively little virus. So I think to me, it seems to be the better choice of the two. What do you think, Mary?
Yeah, it's not only less virus, but an attenuated virus. And so I think it's, you know, I would definitely recommend that child get vaccinated and present that to the family as such so that they kind of understood the difference between the wild-type virus and wild-type infection and just being immunized.
So there are a couple of other things that I think physicians have issues about. Mary, can you go over those just, I think, to be reassuring to people that they really don't need to do some things that they think they need to do?
I'll get phone calls about whether or not if the child vomits or spits up the dose, should you repeat it? And it is recommended that we not readminister that dose. And so that's one of the things that comes up. And also, if a child ends up getting the vaccine and then gets hospitalized, is there anything special that you need to do in that case? And there's not. You know, that child, you know, we really shouldn't have any concern about that.
Okay. So what about premature infants? We talked about those in the nursery. We do know that they're a higher risk. Can we safely immunize premature infants?
So those children under 37 weeks of gestation certainly can be immunized within the licensing range between 6 weeks and 14 weeks and 6 days for the first dose, as long as they're clinically stable and are being, as we talked about, or have been discharged from the nursery.
Mm-hmm. The clinical trials are actually quite encouraging. We were able to, in the large trials, to look at premature infants. Mm-hmm. So you want to comment on that and just...
Yeah, I think it's been very reassuring, and I think, again, it's just important to immunize this high-risk population, make sure that we don't, hesitate about that.
I was very encouraged in those trials that those children had really pretty robust immune response, mm-hmm. even though that they were, their immune systems were less mature than their term infant counterparts. So, yes, I think it's very nice that we have a vaccine that looks like it's safe for those infants and also immunogenic. So what about unanswered questions? What are things that we get asked all the time, things that you can think about that physicians have asked you? We certainly all get phone calls about it that really remain unanswered. And why do you think that we aren't able to answer those questions for folks?
Well, I think one of the most common questions that I certainly get asked is about the interchangeability of the vaccines. And at the moment, we don't really have any conclusive data, but there are some national studies that are ongoing to collect more information about the potential interchangeability of the vaccines. This becomes a pertinent issue, especially when there are vaccine shortages or a vaccine may have to be recalled for a particular reason. So it's very important to get and understand the data. The other question is, how many doses do we actually need for protection? And that may vary based on the host, based on the different characteristics of the child who's being immunized. And then finally, what do we do about late starters? And we've spoken a little bit about children who start their doses late. And so how can we answer those questions? I think there are still several studies that are ongoing that will help us develop some more conclusive evidence.
That's true. Mary, any comments from you about that?
Yeah, I definitely get a lot of questions about the number of doses because there's been all these post-licensure studies, the effectiveness studies that have shown one dose of RV5, has substantial protection, and two doses has great protection, which really looks comparable to the three doses. And so, what are people, what are you all telling families, pediatricians about this difference, especially since RV1 is a two-dose regimen and RV5 is a three-dose?
Well, I certainly feel that we should try and get full doses or full schedules into children, but if they don't, then I think we can be somewhat reassuring that that child will at least be protected in the short term. My big concern is if we give less than a full schedule of vaccine, are we going to see some problems with waning immunity and children becoming sick at 3, 4, or 5 years of age? That we won't know until time produces some kids who that fall into that age range and have less than a full schedule of vaccine.
I think one of the other interesting points also is that both of the vaccines are given on a licensed schedule, so it makes it a little bit easier because the children are coming in for other vaccines as well, so that makes it a little bit easier to...
I think we still just have those children that are just a little bit late and they fall outside the range. We don't have that catch-up opportunity that we have with the other vaccines. And so we're going to see plenty of children that, only get one or two doses of the vaccines. And I think the other question I have just about rotavirus epidemiology is, are we going to see more disease in those unvaccinated children who are older? Obviously, they're not at great risk for getting severe dehydrating diarrhea, but are we creating kind of a cohort of kids that really haven't been protected, what are we going to see in the future with those older kids?
Well, I think it's fortunate that we still have some very good surveillance mechanisms. Mm-hmm. The Centers for Disease Control certainly is monitoring and is continuing to monitor disease activity in the United States, and there are I know, Mary, you belong to a group that is looking at rotavirus vaccine. And I don't know how long you folks are going to be doing that, but it certainly is helpful to have you.
We're definitely going to have 5 more years worth of surveillance, okay. which is terrific because we really want to look at changes in genotypes over time, see if there are any kind of pressures with either the vaccines to really, have either emerging genotypes or any even reassortance that happens. So we're definitely monitoring that. And we did increase our age of surveillance from 3 years of age to 5 years of age, and now up to 10 years of age. And so we're looking for that change in epidemiology in both the hospitalized children and the ED kids.
So, Andy, let's talk about outside the United States. We've been talking mostly about what's gone on with rotavirus disease and vaccine in the United States. So what are the concerns outside of the United States?
Well, while we've really had a tremendous success, as we've both discussed, with the protection and seen a wonderful change in rotavirus epidemiology and a significant impact of both of the vaccines in the United States, we've also seen similar situation internationally. However, there are some concerns with rates of vaccine effectiveness, especially in resource-poor settings. The reason for these is probably multifactorial, but relates to a couple of issues that have been identified. One is that we don't really see a seasonality in international settings with rotavirus. We traditionally, when I was in training, rotavirus was really a winter virus, and so we really saw a lot of infections during that time. In international settings, it seems to be all year round. The other issue is different serotypes and whether the vaccines can afford cross-protection and the emergence of different serotypes in international settings. Another very significant issue is nutritional issues. If you're giving a oral vaccine to a child who may have a compromised gut for either based on either other infections or other co-infecting pathogens, that may decrease the uptake of the vaccine and therefore result in a decreased effectiveness. And then finally, the other question is the role of breastfeeding in the international setting, which is a very, very complex but very interesting and fascinating question, where women who are breastfeeding have high titers of rotavirus antibody in their breast milk, that if a child receives a rotavirus vaccine and then within a short period of time receives breast milk, the antibodies in the breast milk may counteract the live virus vaccine. So there are a lot of very interesting studies and going on looking at this particular issue.
Okay, that's it's great to hear your opinions on rotavirus. I think we know that rotavirus is responsible for a very large burden of disease and a large number of deaths in per year around the world. And post-licensure studies have really shown that the vaccines are very effective, and other studies are underway, especially in those low-income countries, that are really going to be helpful to us. And the safety data we've talked about tonight is really very reassuring that the intussusception risk is low. And we've already seen that in the United States, and we've seen also in other parts of the world as well, that there's been a dramatic impact that rotavirus vaccines have made. We now have the opportunity to change the outcome of children's lives around the world by vaccinating children against rotavirus, but we really need additional studies to be done to optimize the effectiveness of vaccines in resource-poor countries, and we hope that there will be data collected to answer some of the questions that we were unable to answer this evening. Thank you very much, Andy and Mary, for participating in this discussion this evening. I certainly enjoyed it very much, and I hope you did as well.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Peng.
Thank you for participating in this Medscape education activity. For CME CE credit, please click on the Earn CME Credit link.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Rotavirus Immunization, What We Know and What Is Still Unanswered. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.